you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
My truth is the truth that you will never understand.
Private ownership is one single individual giving green light. Doesn't that tell you that your system is more akin to authoritarian dictatorship?
No, we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
What the heck is a deed? How come he can buy our house when it's our house and we live there?
Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. The rights aren't rights if someone can take them away.
They have every man in a straitjacket. To leave a country is like breaking out of jail. And to enter a country is like going through the eye of a needle.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
Shout out! Revolution!
Police Academy essentially opens up policing to the citizens. It's a pretty anarchic idea for an 80s movie.
Not only go on strike, but we need to fire the bosses. This whole you getting paid more, doing less work thing, it's not working out, Steve.
And we're live. Wow. So I'm your host, Dan Platt. This is the Three Left Show. We cover news, culture, and anything of interest from a radical left perspective, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. Program about going in a different direction. Here with me in the studio is Julian Dante.
Hello, hello. How's it going today?
So let's see. Lots of stuff. We got a jam-packed show. We are going to cover the Green New Deal. Its specifics, I've kind of mentioned it in passing in a previous episode, just the different, like, Democratic New Deal being not good, especially how it just fizzled out with how the Democrats played volleyball with it.
Yeah, this kind of early iteration of, like, the concept being introduced in more of a mainstream environment, to me, it's been just kind of a slogan. Different establishment figures can kind of like kick it around, evoke this concept of like this need for this deeper change, evoking the connections, you know,
FDR's actually doing anything substantial.
Yeah. And, you know, I haven't looked at the details of like AOC's proposals. I think those are most likely closer to the mark, but still probably lacking in some of the stronger.
Yeah, I think I have, and in a previous episode, I did kind of cover the differences that it boiled down to the, you know, the Sunrise Movement was like kind of like Obama. We're going to start from a middle position that's palatable to capital, that isn't anti-capitalist, that isn't challenging how we actually do things.
Right,
we'll be exploring what that challenge actually looks like in internal Green Party debates. Where it's actually in radical spaces where, like, the person in the Sunrise Movement, the one who's actually, like, doing a sit-in Nancy Pelosi's office is actually the least radical person in the room, which is
those dang kids.
Yeah. But where to start? I think we'll start with kind of going over what a radical Green New Deal is that's more substantial. It still has drawbacks that we'll discuss. I think... Could you start with the DSA's version?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. DSA Eco-Socialist Caucus, their guiding principles for an eco-socialist Green New Deal. So they are using the same language that the Green Party uses.
And so it starts, humankind has reached a moment of existential crisis. Our activity is causing disastrous climate disruption and Earth's sixth mass extinction event, triggering critical losses of biodiversity. We are already locked in for global warming that will have catastrophic effects, and we are on a slippery path to our own extinction. The IPCC report from 2 years ago.
Feeling depressed yet?
Yeah, sort of. Like, I already had this kind of real depressed phase when it came to the climate change stuff. And then I read The Uninhabitable Earth, and that just laid out every reason we should be terrified. But even in that book, that author, you know, said that the gloom and doom point of view is, you know, useless, because no matter how dire the situation looks, like, it is possible to...
A positive hope is carrying on regardless of high odds.
Yeah, another world is possible. It really is possible to change what we're doing in a way that the Earth is habitable for future generations. And that impetus, that sort of categorical imperative, like pressed upon all social movements, societies and people, I think it already has had a pretty profound effect, and I think it will continue to. So yeah, I don't know. I'm not entirely of the. It's depressing.
Yeah. But, so we'll go over all the reasons laid out in this preamble, like why we need a radical Green New Deal or just radical politics in general, as the show makes the case for every day. Mm-hmm. But so that's a lot of that material I've kind of done, talked about, visit other, but we'll definitely like mention all of these points over and over in the next 2 hours.
Do you want to keep going on the preamble, or should we skip down to the points?
I think you could skip ahead to the paragraph starting, or the last paragraph. The radical Green New Deal we need will not be introduced in a single bill.
Or a resolution. It can only emerge from the grassroots struggles of working people and social movements. Together with our allies, we can organize a powerful, multifaceted movement to catalyze a major left turn in American politics and massive structural changes that are necessary to ensure climate justice and human survival. Because we see the fight for the climate as a struggle against capitalism itself and the myriad forms of oppression which sustain it, we propose to organize within Democratic Socialist America and without around the following guiding principles for Radical Green New Deal. One is...
Just summarize the paragraphs if you could.
Yeah, sure. One is decarbonize the economy fully by 2030. Now, this is different than the warning that was set out by the IPCC in 2018, pardon me, which... rather starkly warned that in order to avoid the threshold of 1.5 degrees of warming, we need to
not just decarbon, like stop producing pollution, but we also need to reverse the pollution we put out by restoring.
Yeah, right? Cut emissions by half globally in 12 years. Yeah, that was the recommendation they set out, I believe.
Okay,
the IPCC.
Right. That's the conservative recommendation for sure.
Yeah, yeah, and. They were saying that's what's needed globally to tackle this, but the eco-socialist proposal makes this really interesting point when it's like, no, decarbonize entirely, because A, industrialized nations have, we put the most into this, and we created this crisis, so there is this moral component to it, but also...
It's also like, the principle of setting goals, like the goal should be a zero pollution economy.
Yeah, and richer countries are more able to enact a lot of the sweeping changes required to get this going sooner. And given that we can't guarantee like the actions of other nation states, we need to fully decarbonize because if other nations don't, we still need to hit the overall threshold required to prevent as much warming as possible. Because as you know, this is laid out in The Uninhabitable Earth very clearly, which is why we need to avoid the doom and gloom perspective is like, a world where the planet is warmed 3 degrees is very bad. It's a dark place. It's a much harder life for most people on the planet. But a world that's warmed to 8 degrees is also possible, and that is one that could eclipse any possibility of human life.
It's Venus type. I mean,
yeah, like there is like. The Uninhabitable Earth, that wasn't a hyperbolic title. Like, he put it as a statistically narrow possibility, but the fact that we've, like, brought that kind of apocalypse into the alignment of the possible is really this imperative to stop this as much as we possibly can. So, yeah, we should set the goal to fully.
It's certainly meant to rebuke the. We can't really have an effect on the climate that much.
Yeah, and like that it's already too late. It's like, well, yes, the planet is already warmed 1 degree. That's locked in. Most likely we're going to get another half a degree if we start doing almost everything right rather
which
soon,
yeah,
which would take, you know, a revolutionary upsurge. It would take a truly radical phase change in the way we organize and the way we understand our role in society and the world.
And there's even an ignorance of what revolution really means. Like when asked, I think just a standard mainstream article, I think it was like, is America ready for revolution? Or is it like, could there be one, you know, with all of the cheating and the basically since democracy as an institution is completely degraded and non-functional as even elections as a release valve for our ire. What, you know, is America on the verge of a revolution? Like, well, first of all, we're not organized enough. Even like the more spontaneous looking revolutions in the past in world history, still, there was still a base of organizations that like made them possible. There would be like an instigating incident, like say the storming of the Bastille, by women and other such events. But there was also unions and organizing happening in the prior decade.
Yeah.
So my vision of the most positive outcome of the next of the 2020s is we spend this decade building militant organizations out of the progress that, if any progress has been made in the last decade, because when I look at the last decade, the teens, what progress did the left make, or what did anything even happen? And as mentioned in the gut-punching article we're going to end the show with, that the progress we've made is that we have more of these movements that say no to the system overall, and thus create radicalization for and the appetite for radical organizations, which the left has not been building over our lifetimes. They stopped doing it after 72.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some militant organizations, but they were small. They were issue-based, just like, say, Stop the Iraq War. I mean, it was something that I always kind of go back to, and how, like, older generations kind of, quote-unquote, failed me, activist-wise, was the opposition to the Iraq War was, it's Bush's war, it's the Bush agenda. There was no structural critique of it. There was no systematic, like, view of it at all. And so it's like, all our problems will be solved once we get Bush out of office. And I see it all over again every time. It's like, we just got to be Trump. We just got to be Trump. It's like, did getting rid of Bush solve anything? Did it end the warfare in the Middle East? Did it make people richer? It didn't make black people richer. Nope. Didn't make me richer. Didn't make anybody who went to college richer. So, yeah, it's just like, that's the wrong approach. So whenever I see a vote blue, no matter who, or and they say, I'm stamping my feet and being demanding by saying, I want something else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to vote for Buttigieg for president.
Yeah,
I didn't, and so on.
Yeah, like one of the key litmus tests I've sort of had in the back of my mind since Trump took over, litmus test is like whether or not we might actually see our way out of this. Is, are people seeing Trump as the cause of our problems, an aberration that needs to be gotten rid of for a sort of return to a this kind of normalcy, or will he be seen as a symptom of a broader problem?
Yeah, we're not the only show discussing that.
Yeah, if he's seen as a symptom rather than the cause, I think we do honestly have a chance. And one of the, you know, you bring up some good points with the anti-Iraq war movement. It was, I mean, I was very young at the time, but it was a very tough time to have any kind of left-wing perspective at all. And so one thing that I think we have as a sort of an advantage during the Trump era is that people are seriously discussing alternatives. People are seriously considering that deeper critique. And there's a broader awareness of the more systemic problems than there was then, if I can sorry to be so vague.
Okay, but so let's do what like Kyle Kalinske and other like and even Jimmy Dore doesn't do. So let's go back to the list.
Cool.
So the next one, number two, is democratize control over major energy systems and resources.
Yep. So nationalize fossil fuel producers to phase them out as quickly as necessary. Socialize fossil fuel dependent industries so that they can be scaled back or transformed to a fossil free process. Establish public ownership of utilities in the electric grid and support energy cooperatives and community solar and wind projects for democratic control of the shift to 100% renewable energy.
So from monoculture to a diverse farming base.
Yep.
So on. It's a long laundry list. But it's good to kind of
nationalize and socialize the energy.
Because otherwise it does all becomes a slogan if we don't list it out. And so many news covering shows on YouTube don't, because they're kind of following the news cycle. And I so don't want to do that with the show.
Yeah, we're going to need to democratically control energy production if we're going to fix this in a way that's just for people at large. We can't, regulate through this or just allow the continued ownership of a class that has diametrically different interests to our own.
So this will come up in other ways, but I just want to give a personal spin. There's the, because as we've taken the approach of like growing renewable energy via markets and just market incentives, tax credits, neoliberal policy, growing renewable energy with neoliberalism, it's very industrialized and it does harm people. And there's, and I always like make a point of covering little stories where you have local communities pushing back against like a solar farm. Not just because like the petty reason would be like it ruins their view, right? But when they say it ruins their view of their farming valley, what they're saying is open space matters. It needs to be preserved. Open space, especially when it's good open farming, like the good south-facing areas for solar farms are also good for real farms.
Right.
And the last step of a civilization before it collapses is it builds up on its best farming land. And that is what we have done in triplicate with suburbia. And solar farms is kind of just an extension of that.
Yeah, and I think that taps into a larger point of the whole ethos of, like, the Green New Deal. This understanding that it has to be this environmental transition has to be done in a way that centers the people who are most impacted by this and capitalism at large. It has to be done in the interests of the people and in a way that benefits their lives rather than constantly being asked to, you know, make further sacrifices. So it's not going to be done in a set of, you know, banning plastic straws and stuff like that. It'll be, it needs popular momentum behind it. Otherwise we'll have no leverage or power base from which to actually enact these reforms. And it risks retaliation if environmental policies are pursued in a way that are not in the interests of the you know, people who are here.
Which is kind of the Sunrise Movement and the Bill McKibben kind of approach, which is we don't want to upset the ruling class where they come down on us, because some of them are older and they do have an experience of they took it too far and the ruling class came down on them in the form of the war on drugs and mass incarceration, and they know the power of the state firsthand. And they don't want it to happen again. But in doing so, they kind of have surrender.
The war on drugs and terror never stopped. Like, at this point, doesn't really...
It turned into the war on terror. And then, to be a left-winger was to be on the side of the terrorists. And thus, it continued. And thus, instead of fighting that full-heartedly, they kind of like, no, we're just fighting Bush, not America.
Right.
Just Bush. We want, a Democrat. Kerry can fight terrorism better. That was the claim. And, of course, it wasn't a winning campaign at all. And it's just Dems repeat things. Anyway, I covered that in the last live show.
Yeah, so point three, center the working class in a just transition to an economy of societal and ecological care. Guarantee a job with union wages and benefits to everyone who wants one by creating millions of public sector jobs and funding massive direct investments to build decarbonized infrastructure in critical sectors like renewable energy, regenerative agriculture, soil and ecosystem restoration, the yada, yada, yada. And this is a key point. Also expanding support for low-carbon care sectors like healthcare, education, domestic work. So it seems a little counterintuitive. Like, why does the Green New Deal, why does this thing get aimed at stopping climate change talk about union jobs and public ownership and things like that? It seems like tangential issues. But
left-wing nationalism.
But they're really not. And Naomi Klein makes this really excellent point. It's, I forget where, when, but she's like, teaching, nursing, those kind of things, they're low carbon jobs. So like she had this sort of way of like counting, reprioritizing economic investment towards the satisfaction of human need. Those are in their own way green jobs, because that work is not contributing directly to further environmental catastrophe. So low carbon care sectors, healthcare, education, and domestic work, like empower people and make a just economy where people can make a living without destroying the world. So it's not so counterintuitive after all. Four, related to that, decommodify survival by guaranteeing living wages, healthcare, childcare, housing, food, water, energy, public transit, a healthy environment, and the necessities for all. Ensure market forces do not displace frontline and working class communities from their neighborhoods by implementing universal rent control, and work cooperatively with communities in the line of climate danger to relocate to safer grounds. So that all, I think, pretty much I don't know. That's
which
that,
might
that's an obvious
which
one
might include like paying off landowners mm-hmm. for the land that's actually going to be lost.
Yeah,
because otherwise it's just one large sunk cost fallacy after another. Yeah, a short story video I watched via Real News Network was a Philippine fishing village where they've basically their island has been sinking for a while, and their houses are built on the roofs of their previous houses. And, of course, even those are being flooded. So a lot of other families and the children have moved, but some of the parents have stayed just because it's their home, but it can't really be anymore.
Yeah.
And so it's just nothing but regret and sadness, just trying to make it.
Yeah, and the way we react to the communities that are going to be displaced at this point. I mean, there are cities that are going to be underwater within the next 20 years. It's kind of, there are some things that are too late to stop. There are islands that are already sinking. And how we treat those people, how we react to those people who need to relocate, but also contributed the least amount to this catastrophe, but are suffering the most. Giving them a just world as well, that's what reparations is going to look like. That's
because obviously reparations is about also accounting for the past value, not just providing actual value that everyone's due in the first place.
Yeah, I think it needs to be tied. It can be a truly radical concept if it's tied, if it's historical injustice is tied in with current.
Number five, reinvent our communities to serve people and planet, not profit. Hey, they took that from us.
Yay.
Green Party used that in the past.
We plagiarized you.
It was Stein's slogan in 2012. People plan over profit. Anyway, go on.
Yep, that's good. Oh, I lost the page.
Facilitate the creation of neighborhood transition councils. So this is direct democracy on a local level, which then act as hubs for basically local planning and thus not market economics. Mm-hmm. Making economic decisions on what do we build, playground, water fountains, what are we not building, high roads, you know, whatever. Or, you know, we do still want good roads. How are we going to fix them up? Decriminalize, decarcerate, demilitarize spaces across all of society. You know, to do this is, you know, it's all anti-statism. And we'll cover that. Legally, immaterially, do you have your page?
Okay. Yeah, I got the page back. Yeah, so demilitarize, decolonize, and strive for a future of international solidarity and cooperation.
And all those things have, like, deep meanings, which probably...
Yeah,
there are articles in themselves I'm collecting, like how to decolonize America.
Yeah.
What the hell does that mean?
Yeah, it's a big concept. Enacting policies and job and joint entreaties to meet the existential threat of climate change and abandon the doom strategy of global military domination. So this gets into the fact that the United States military is the largest, has the largest carbon footprint of, I think it's any institution on Earth. I mean, it depends on how you measure it. Like factory farms, if they were all counted in aggregate, would, top that off. But yeah, the military is one of the greatest polluters on Earth. Like this massive war machine takes vast pools of energy, and it's entirely unnecessary and only, you know, kills people. So yeah, the anti-imperialism is related to.
But they are always trying to be more efficient. This is their caveat. It's greenwashing to me, but it's just like, oh, we actually do have to be as efficient as possible. You know, for everything amount of fuel you have to bring in, that's more transportation.
Yeah.
Like any company, but it's still like the fact that you're existing and doing everything you're doing in the first place, that's not questioned, and that's. We're going to question it.
Yeah, Warren talked about sort of greening the military, which sounds like it's kind of greenwashing thing you're describing.
Oh, absolutely.
Here. Yeah, like this isn't about putting a solar panel on the tank. This is really about we need to stop making tanks. Like that's what's actually going to make the
difference. Unless we want to make some kind of like a fun sport out of tank fighting.
Yeah, we could keep some. We could keep some and where have kind of a monster truck thing.
The ammo could be like blanks where like they still. You know, like,
yeah,
flares, but like, it still looks like a battle, but like, anyway.
Yeah, when we have socialism, we can do cool stuff. Yeah. We can have fun with all the old, tanks and the ships.
It will use a lot less energy for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway,
and last, redistribute resources from the worst polluters with just and progressive taxes on the rich. big corporations and undirty industry, as well as by driving funds away from policing, prisons, and our government's bloated military budget, which have nothing to do with the defense of living people within the American borders and everything to do with maintaining imperial dominance over other nations and capitalist control of the world's resources.
Now, the first half of those were like more wonkish lists of policies, and then as you go down the list, it becomes more abstract, more like guiding principles, overall goals, which are great. But otherwise, yeah. And then basically, this is all repeated in kind of Green Party literature. So I want to spend the next bit of time on. This is just a Howie Hawkins campaign page. I do kind of focus on him a bit more because he is our kind of presumptive candidate, and he's also the guy I've been around as our gubernatorial candidate for three cycles.
Yeah.
So let me just read out his preamble, which is much shorter, but it is a campaign page. Our eco-socialist Green New Deal encompasses two major, an economic bill of rights. So these are like boilerplate things, the slogans. Economic Bill of Rights, Green Economy Reconstruction Program. You only have to remember two things. Bill of Rights, which finally fulfill Roosevelt's 44 call on Congress to develop programs to secure basic human rights for all. That would be the four freedoms. The economic Green Economy Reconstruction Program is then that decarbonized by 2030, which basically is the same list that we just gave with it from the DSA document. The Economic Bill of Rights will be realized through ongoing programs of public provision. So it's all still kind of welfare state-centered spending. But this is what's added. Implementing the Green New Deal will require eco-socialism, social ownership in key sectors in order to democratically plan the coordinated reconstruction of all economic sectors of ecological sustainability. That's a bit of a mouthful. But the keywords there, social ownership, not public ownership, because that's usually the first big response of, nationalization, which again is like Bernie Sanders' headlines of nationalize this, nationalize that, nationalize utilities of all kinds that we depend on and shouldn't be market-based because then they abuse us as consumers, as commodities themselves, as objects, objectifying us.
Yep.
We need to undo that, and that at least starts in utility sectors and then can spread out to shoes. Because I think one of my first kind of like thought experiments I gave myself in trying to understand socialism was like, well, maybe I'd be okay if like the shoes are made by not a corporation, not for profit. Just thinking about all the evils of shoe production, at least because that's usually the first thing you learn about when you're a teenager.
Yeah, and challenging the structures of capital is essential because, you know, we talk about, China has the largest carbon footprint right now, not the United States. But a lot of the driving force of that is the fact that they're a major manufacturer and export for a lot of consumer goods in the United States and in richer countries. So there really is this, when we're looking at who's responsible and what structures need to be altered, and what power dynamics need to change in order to fully tackle this. We're not just looking at this in a nationalist lens. It really does have to be challenging the edifice of capital itself. So, yeah.
And the how we pay for it is like the third item on the site. I'll link to it in the show notes. It really comes down to cut the military. Cut the military even like at least by half.
Yeah.
And that's something that, say, the AOC Green New Deal will, it's like, it was paid for with, it was just basically a marginal tax somewhere. It was just like, we would raise taxes on, richer people, but for sure. So it is redistributionist, which is the buzzword there. But we don't want to just redistribute. We want to, part of challenging capital is how do we distribute the wealth in the first place? Why do we have to wait for wealth to be accumulated by billionaires and then tax them? It's extra steps. It's inefficient. We don't need the inequality in the first place.
And it also centers the power of the ruling classes.
Right.
Like it's treating the resources as if they were theirs to begin with, treating the oil rig and the natural resources under it as if they were the personal property of this one individual, and they got to decide whether or not the world burns.
And to respond to the libertine in all of us of like nationalizing, it's like, well, I don't want it in the state's hands. That's just another authority. And which is why the democratizing impetus has to be there. It's why we put in all our documents. It's like, look, we're not just trying to Stalinize things, even though that's still slightly better than what we have now. It's not the only thing we want to do. Once it's nationalized, made, you know, public, publicizing it means say the board of trustees is not elected officials or appointed by elected officials. They are 1/3 the workers who maintain the system. It's 1/3 reps from community populations, you know, which may at the end of the day be like people from the council of mayors, something like that. But that would still be an interim because, as the DSA document points out, like, we want to build community decision-making orgs, and then there would be a delegate from there that would basically send an email to, it's like, this is how much power we really want, this is how we want it, we discussed it in a quick way, then you can figure it out, but we don't, of course, want to leave it all up to you.
Yeah, so not only do we offer people, like, good union jobs for this kind of phase change into a more just social order, but we also want to give workers direct control and autonomy to whatever degree possible in the immediate term, and of course full control in the long term of their work environment itself, in tandem with the community are embedded in, as you said. So yeah, it has to, the only way this is actually going to happen is if the dynamics of power are changed in a way that that you should have democratic control over your workplace, in the same sense that we pretend that you have democratic control over civil society. Because right now your workplace is a dictatorship. And
everyone kind of understands, like, the boss thing. I think that was the question that was what Chapo Trap House brought up about, like, Burning Winning. It's like, look, you just ask people, no matter how white they are, they understand that their boss is not their friend.
Yeah, a lot of people do understand that. The more working class they are, the more they tend to.
Though sometimes they do. It's like, oh no, my boss is my friend. Well, in some cases they literally are like the friend, but it's also just whatever. So anyway, there also are the list of progressive taxes in the, you know, Hawkins Green New Deal, and probably would be included in anything as part of like trying to equalize the economy while we're democratizing it, because it wouldn't happen all at once. Ecological taxes would be included, like a land value tax. Instead of property taxes, I don't know if I fully discussed land value taxes.
I'm not sure I know what it is. What is it?
A land value tax is where you tax the value of a land instead of the value of the entire property, which would be the land and the house.
Okay.
So a land tax is lower than a property tax.
Right.
And a land tax, the value of land, is dependent on public investment, not private investment.
Okay.
So by taking private investment out of the equation, which would be like how much a bank puts in or whatever, it's based on the roads and the public and the overall labor system, right, of who built it. That cool. Means generally that, like, say the collection becomes lesser, but it's actually, no, it can be the same because a lot of property is untaxed. Mm-hmm. So I think how property taxes become unfair is just think about, say, someone who's retired, but the property of their house has been increasing. They have to keep paying more taxes even though their income, and as well as most people's income, is stagnant.
Yeah.
Property values can change and fluctuate based on private whims or banker whims, or whether or not housing is in demand or not. But the land is always going to be much more stable in price, mm-hmm. and it only changes based on, say, public investment. So there's a lot of advantages, but it doesn't. A land value tax itself, of course, none of these things themselves just challenge capitalism overall, but some of them are more getting there. And of course, that's the point of having a Green New Deal, is that's a totality of policy.
Yeah, just like
that we're not just going to wonk over, but like mm-hmm. we want to implement on any level possible first. So, and then the third thing, which is pretty important, is public banking, which is to nationalize the Fed. So that should get any libertarians titillated. And of course, nationalize the biggest banks, which usually comes in the form of the next time they fail, instead of bailing them out, we nationalize them.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, how Jill put it in 2016 in her platform.
Yeah, and unfortunately, a second recession might already be baked into the... I mean, it is already baked into the system. Capitalism survives off of its collapses. But we...
Every 15 years.
yeah, we didn't change anything. Like, none of the core, none of the core reasons the economy collapsed in 2008 have changed at all. So, there's been no real adjustment.
Yeah, this whole thing about regulating greed, it's just the wrong way of thinking about it. It's moralizing an economic, a systemic problem, making it individualized. And that's something that, you know, we can talk about till the cows come home. And there are plenty of readings on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's move on. Unless you have some other thoughts. But I want to cover the Red Deal, which is covered by Team Vogue. Which I think another year and we won't have to say this again, but Team Vogue has turned into quite the democratic socialist publication.
Yeah, it's real cool. Making the kids
radicalized.
Do revolution.
Yeah, it's a radicalizing publication now, in terms of educating with just the basics of radical civil education, which basically it's like these are the magazines I wish were laid out in the dentist office when I was growing up. And this isn't about talking about where we're going or the goals, though it's, of course it is as well. But it's more about how these indigenous activists are reacting to the Democrat Green New Deal, or at least what was bandied about in the mainstream as the Green New Deal by AOC and other the squad, and how like, oh, this isn't going far enough. And basically all of the critiques laid out in this article are basically addressed by the radical visions of the organizations we are part of, which then comes back to like, we need to step up our outreach. All of these other activists need to know that we exist and that we're with them. And basically our platforms and what we stand for is exactly what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I'm always communicating. It's a phrase I hadn't read in a while, but in a Facebook spat that, you know, just for fun, more or less, at work, last night, an old timer, he was a black man, but still an old timer. He called, you know, what the Green Party does, puts out as a vanity platform. I hadn't seen that phrase in at least 5 years now, calling what like we have is a vanity platform, mostly because I just don't pay attention to what centrists say about us. But they consider everything we do to be impractical, even though it's as we laid out with the book in this non-escapable planet, the uninhabitable planet, it is amazingly necessary that we decarbonize the economy right now. So I think it's amazingly practical that we democratize, that the goals we lay out, these radical platforms, they are what are practical.
Mm-hmm.
If we're just going to reclaim that language. But sometimes reclaiming the language of your opponent isn't always the right thing. You know, you got to carve out your own path as well. I have just discussed for years that too many of us spend time hate watching our opponents, whether it be in college when it was just, you know, Fox News hating, as if Fox News is a source of all bad propaganda. And like, no, all the cable news is bad propaganda. It's just a different flavor. And now, you know, if you're a Bernie-crat, then MSNBC is something that you can also hate watch.
Sure can.
And the Dem debates, you know, I don't watch any.
I did that last night.
Yes. So Julian, do you feel more enriched as a participant in society by watching that?
No, of course not. It's you know, it's six centrists and one person who, you know, approaches the realm of sensible politics, like the United States realm of the possible when it comes to political figures is so far to the right that I don't know, no one should be to the right of Sanders or Warren and taken seriously. So I just resent every second that I have to listen to any of these other people and
someone who does take them seriously. But oh yeah, I want to segue. Well, first I want to finish my point that and there's other ones after it. Hate watching Fox News. It's something like I 2010 or so, like I just stopped doing it. I stopped like paying attention. And when I would talk to people about it, I'm like, well, I just feel like it's a better use of my time to actually talk and think about what the left should be doing. Like, what are we talking about? And I just, especially with all the podcasts I listened to at the time, the conversations, the YouTube videos, Young Turks and whatever. It's like we're always just reacting to our opponents.
Yeah, and letting them set the narrative.
Yeah, yeah. Always letting them set the narrative and then reacting based on like what they're putting out and what their like plans are. What are our plans? We're not discussing them enough. Now we're starting to more with, you know, the kind of mass movements we've gotten in the last 10 years. But there's still this the following of the news cycle, especially around the presidential campaigns. Mm-hmm. And then you're just living for the next election, which as a Green, I never want to do. I usually take make it every third year. I care about campaigning or doing an election or helping more than usual. Not just burnout, but just like I don't want to set my activism to the pace of the system.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And so that kind of ties into why bother going over these grand kind of treatises or these set of policy proposals that are so drastically far outside of anything that we have now. Like, why bother contemplating something that seems so distant?
Or could pass a Republican Senate.
Yeah, yeah. And it is important not to set the limits of your imagination based on the desires of our enemies.
So I also want to it's sort of a response, but something I wanted to talk about, which was I talked with my father about and he did give me okay. We were skiing on Thursday. So we were on the chairlift and he's discussing because I wanted to know because it came up during lunch with his buddies about how Bernie and Warren are too far left to win a general election.
And oh, my God.
Yeah, so these are boomer ski instructors.
All right, the electable guy got fourth in Iowa, so...
Well, that's what probably I'll check in with him again, but he said he was leaning in the support of Biden.
Yeah, my hope is that the electability argument will really collapse once the electable candidates are incapable of winning elections.
And, of course, the most like painful thing to cruel... way of putting it is like if I do register as a Dem to vote in the primary, it would be to just cancel out one of the votes of my parents, which is just horrible to think about.
Harm reduction.
Which is why I'm saying it in this softer tone.
We are all canceling out the votes of our this or that reactionary
relative.
So.
And that's the problem with competitive voting is that it's like it's not really about voting for what you're for. Which is what minor party voting is really about, because in the case of voting Green or Libertarian, you actually aren't canceling out someone else's vote. You are voting for this outside of the game. I mean, well, I think of it as like you're playing the master's game, but not by their rules. At least that's what keeps me in the party and not just working, just saying no to elections like so many of my other radical associates.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of looking at it.
Let's see, is there anything worth reading from the Red Deal
article? I would like to get into.
Oh yeah, I wanted to mention something that upset me slightly was that they give the Green New Deal as a concept and policy credit to the Sunrise Movement.
Actually, I just saw that section. That's not entirely true. They on technicalities here it checks out because the Green New Deal. Popularized by the
Sunrise Movement. Okay.
So they don't credit it as being originized. Okay. Originized.
Yeah.
Geez. Yeah. So
written. But yeah.
The reason it's in the more popular in the public discourse now, it does have a lot to do with the Sunrise Movement and AOC. This new
but not mentioning
congressional
where it's
figure.
From is still an oversight.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah. It's an older idea that has roots obviously back into. Environmentalist movements.
Oh, wait, 09, 010.
Yeah, I wanted to read one paragraph here in the Red New Deal thing, sort of highlighting why it's important to take indigenous perspectives into account and
of course.
Center their needs when it
but
comes to this.
Before you do that, I want to circle back around to like my father. I wanted to explain, especially since you were kind of dismissive, why do our parents vote Biden? And Chapo has they're not quite accurate when they give their take on this or something. But what my father explained to me over, you know, very in some level of discomfort was that he really just doesn't know what else to do.
Yeah.
He put it in terms of like, you know, when in the 70s, you know, he was in the anti-war movement. He was fighting the draft. You know, his draft number was 200 and something. Mm-hmm. He needed to fight that. and that was a fight that was mostly won. But when the draft was made a lottery, then a lot of he noticed himself the energy, a lot of air was taken out of it. So he kind of repeated the kind of narrative or the view that, like, you know, you got to it's completely, you know, he understands how kind of a little crazy it is,
yeah,
that we got to make deals with the Republicans if we're going to advance anything. But it's also about the form of harm reduction, which is a Democrat as president still is less harmful than a Republican. And this is something that even other people as radical as us recognize, which I feel they're putting more importance on the statistical data that says in a Democrat is in office, less people die. I'm like, sure, less people die, but then it's like, well, they're surviving and not living, kind of a philosophical overlay that could be put on it.
Yeah, if you're an older person and you've been active in politics, even remotely, for, you know, any stretch of the past 40 years, it's the dominant paradigm has just been the centrist Democrat. That's the option you get, and that's all that's possible now. So it's the notion that we actually, not only can we dream of something more, but we sort of have to at this critical juncture. It's a difficult transition for a lot of people to make if, you know, you've been alive for a while and kind of mostly lived through the decline and disappearance of any kind of left alternative, the depoliticization of civil society at large. Like, that's a hard spell to wave off.
And when I kind of say, like, well, this is the time, it's coming back around, like, we're ready to fight, the energy is here, and the possibilities will emerge beyond appeasing Republicans with centrism, and he kind of sighs and goes, like, I just don't have that fight in me anymore. I mean, he's approaching 70, so of course. And then it's like, well, just all I ask is you kind of just be neutral and let the people who were your age in 1970 do the fighting.
Yeah. You know, maybe someone like your dad and people like your dad would who are worried about the electable option, you know, I'm hoping they'll come around once, if the Sanders movement is successful and starts proving itself as capable of engaging an expanded electorate and actually, you know, winning these races.
Now, I'm not confident in that when the response from its leadership is vote harder. And not volunteer to make sure that you're poll watching, which I'm sure is probably being spread around, but it's definitely something to say, like, poll watch.
Yeah.
Poll watch, and what else is there to hold the, you know, election system accountable? I mean, so much of it was set ahead of time by, say, Democratic officials at the state level, and it basically led to the undercounting of Bernie votes in New York last time around. And they weren't punished. They basically just said, we'll do better next time. They just kind of like, yo, I guess we've messed up.
Yeah.
But none of them went to jail. They kept all of, they were still in the same positions. It's still the same people. No accountability, really, except just, oopsie, I guess we'll do better next time.
Yeah, and the only thing we have this time around that went in that direction is the registration was extended. Like, a lot of people
last time there was that reform, weren't able
to vote because they didn't realize they needed to change parties a year ahead of time, which is one of the most regressive laws in the country.
Now it's I think 3 months or half a year.
Yeah,
now it's half a year,
something like that. But like, a lot of people were disenfranchised last time around, and it's something that keeps happening. So we need to, you know, when we're engaging with these systems, we also need to challenge them.
Okay, so go on to what was the paragraph of the Red Deal?
Right, and that's why Red New Deal. Okay, so back to the topic we were talking about a little while ago. So, yeah, centering indigenous voices, why that's important. Water protectors and land defenders. So this is referring to Standing Rock and other similar movements who live on the front lines of environmental degradation are often the first to protest its destruction, are mentioned once in what is being heralded as a revolutionary policy our country needs right now. So, oh, that last sentence kind of didn't make sense.
Oh, no.
No, but, like, Yeah, it's just highlighting the fact that the people who are in the frontline communities are often poorer or often indigenous, and that is not a coincidence. So these are the communities and these are the voices who are generally aware of these things sooner than the public at large. So when it comes to like centering their voices and needs, it's because of the fact that like indigenous people have understood the way in which American capitalism destroys the environment and in the process eats its own tail for a very long time. It's a discourse that reaches back. So it's something that has to be accounted for. And we have to attack the climate crisis in, we've said it several times, in a way that centers the needs of the people who are most devastated by it.
Wonderful. Okay. So this has been the first hour of the Three Left Show. For going in a different direction, I'm your host, Dan Platt, with Julian Dante. Visit our social media, Twitter and Facebook, Three Left Show. We are currently live streaming on Facebook, so check that out. The camera's just on me at the moment.
We are?
Yeah.
We're live streaming?
But just it's just on me,
hello.
Unfortunately. Someday we'll have an independent camera that'll connect to this computer.
I got my nails did.
Yeah. I can't stop looking at the nice shimmering blue.
Yeah.
How was golf night?
It was fun.
Yeah.
I painted my nails myself for the first time. I've painted them a few times. Usually like a friend will do it for me. Yeah, I did it.
Is it myself. That hard?
No, it's really easy, but I had a few drinks and I kept forgetting that the nails were still wet, so I kept like using my hand to like just put on my jacket or something. Blotches everywhere.
Still got housekeeping. Let's see. So the main website, threelefts.news, full archive. I've now added descriptions for every episode in that archive, one-line descriptions. So that took me a few hours, but it's probably well worth it if you do visit. Since in podcast land, where you can go to any podcast app, you can find the Three Left Show, the last 10 episodes. But I like having everything accessible because I'm a communist like that. So otherwise, now let's listen to the new track from the Newsies, a Disney production. Yay.
Yay.
Open the gates and seize the day. Don't be afraid and don't delay. Nothing can break us. No one can make us give our rights away. Arise and seize the day.
Time to seize the day.
Now is the time to seize the day.
Send out the call and join the fray.
Send out the call and join the fray.
Bronx will be riding if we're united.
Let us seize the day.
Friends of the friendless, seize the day.
Friends of the friendless, seize the day.
Raise up the torch and light the way.
Raise up the torch and light the way. Proud and defiant, we'll slay the giant. Let us seize. The day, neighbor to neighbor, father to son, one for all and one for all. Open the gates and seize the day, open the gates and seize the day. Don't be afraid and don't delay, don't be afraid and don't delay. Nothing can break us. No one can make us give our rights away.
We're back.
Yes, hey-o.
That's right. Back for the second hour of the Three Left Show. Your host, Dan Platt and Julian Adante, discussing left-wing politics to the max.
Hey-o.
We spent the last hour discussing the radical Green New Deal, what it is, not just that what was reported in the mainstream media, which the Republicans punked the Dems because they're such failures. They didn't want the Dems to vote for a resolution for a Green New Deal because it meant they were voting for higher taxes and communism, I guess. And even though it was completely friendly to capital, kind of like the Obama stimulus, which was half tax cuts to middle class and above and half just road building.
Yeah.
And other types of shovel-ready infrastructure projects, which were nice, but a pittance compared to what was actually needed to actually have an updated infrastructure. So I want to cover in the first next half hour. It may take that long, but...
Oh, we didn't get to do that yet. Okay, never mind.
Which is also from Counterpunch. So that is a Counterpunch article.
Right, we're doing something else first. Green Party debate.
I feel like this goes better than... So I do have summaries. So the guy basically describes three different panels that happened over the course of a month in Missouri. So this is written by Adon Fritz, Green Party Debates, Green New Deal. So this is our internal dialogue because a radical Green New Deal is like everything laid out is for us the starting point of the discussion. It's like all of that is a given of like what we want. Then we discuss even without the strategy, actually. I mean, the strategy is always kind of, we've already figured that out. We're electoral party and we're going to organize with grassroots movements. And do it with ever-increasing militancy until we have what an actual revolution might look like. Just a political one. Despite the furor over the Green New Deal, many of its supporters have no idea of the wide variety of views on it, especially within the Green Party and other radical circles, where it originated in the U.S. From June through August of 2019, Missouri Greens held public discussions contrasting at least three different views. In June, Green Party of St. Louis hosted a forum, The Green New Deal, Promise and Problems. This is something we also did here in the Capital Region of New York. It led off with Ben Elsenberg of the Sunrise Movement describing his concerns with climate change and the extreme need for political groups to demand a switch to 100%. So just kind of a build buy-in via the organizations that exist. Local Greens had coordinated an Extinction Rebellion protest in Earth Day in April and realized the widespread appeal of the AOC approach. So this is from the Sunrise Movement's point of view, which is the work with Democrats and get that mainstream buy-in. Henry Robinson of the Missouri Green Party followed, criticizing the popular perspective, Democratic Party perspective. He uses DP as a shorthand, which I don't never see. The perspective that climate problems require a massive, urgent response. He emphasized the destructiveness of economic growth itself, something I've done on this program, and concluded massive is not the cure for massiveness. Robinson pointed out that steel can't be produced steel can't be mass-produced without fossil fuels, and insisted that the Earth has hit its limit, meaning that production must be cut back.
It's a really interesting point. It's one that's often missed in socialist circles. Well,
it comes up all the time whenever nuclear power is discussed and someone with more top-down views, just like, oh, I don't get all these hippies and they're like hating nuclear power. We need nuclear power. And I've discussed in the past why that's wrong. I mean, nuclear power still produces nuclear waste and that has to be dumped. And the uranium mining in itself, the supply of uranium is limited to a 30-year supply, and maybe that's just if we switch to all our power to nuclear, but I think even just increasing it means we're just buying time.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a solution, and again, in the previous episodes and future ones, I'll discuss that it was in the Green Debunking number three episode, which is the newest online, is that we just cannot produce the same amount of energy we do now.
Yeah.
In any fashion. Like, cutting back is pretty much the only actual option once you look at the logic and the reality of it.
Yeah, like major scale construction projects, like they also use resources in order and use fossil fuel in order to create them. I think one of the largest industries with one industry with a much larger carbon footprint that we don't think of is like concrete. The production of concrete requires
massive.
It's massive, and
we built everything out of it, which is a big problem.
Yeah, so we need to start rethinking not only what we're building and where we're setting our priorities, but also what these things are made of. Are we able to green scale the to any extent the process of production itself? So not only transitioning outside of fossil fuels, but descaling or natural. Recreating our production process.
I look at it as figuring out how to do natural building and scaling it up. But of course, everything that's scaled up in nature is just many small things. So if you take a small is beautiful approach and you just have communities do natural building and the materials are provided one way or another, usually locally, which then lowers the cost and the energy input, then you can just go forward. So you can still have kind of infill construction, like with concrete, but instead of using hard concrete that's hard and basically not very comfortable.
Also absorbs heat.
You use a softer concrete, which has the density of wood. So you basically make a soft concrete wall. It has the same strength as a wood wall, but without having to actually build it out of wood.
Also, it's easier to burst through dramatically because it's softer. So if you ever want to Kool-Aid man it and make that kind of entry, the Green New Deal makes that possible. That's often not
human construction makes many things possible that otherwise are basically, oh, we can't do that. All the parts are not interchangeable. So Howie Hawkins spoke next, was the first to run for office on a Green New Deal platform in 2010. He said that his original, which basically was one of the things, seeing him run then, was one of the things that got me to I think I'll vote green this time and not be just a Democrat. He said his original U.S. program seeks 100% renewables, yada, yada. We covered all that. Oh, yeah, but the phrasing he uses is would mount a World War II scale mobilization by investing in green businesses. Now, that's kind of his code for nationalizing industry and planning production so that we actually build the EV cars or the buses instead of letting the private sector figure out how they're going to produce for demand that doesn't exist yet.
One nuance that I think is sort of missed in this article is the one Robertson's perspective that massive is not a cure for massiveness. Very well taken. And often a point that's underemphasized. But when Hawkins is talking about the World War II scale mobilization, yes, he is talking about that kind of infrastructure investment that can have its own problematics. But also the investment is in union jobs and healthcare work and things that do not have green jobs as defined by jobs that are not contributing to the climate crisis. So that's also a side of the World War II scale mobilization and investment. So it's
but I argue, and so does some of the Green Party people here in this article, that any job within the capitalist system is contributing to climate change.
And we all are in our daily activities and the fact that we're continuing to consume and all of that, but I don't know.
Everything we think is one choice is actually 15 choices.
Yeah, but there are ways to actually descale and reprioritize our needs. So a nurse,
without being massive,
a nurse still might drive to work, and that's a carbon footprint. But it's different than investing a bunch of jobs in coal mining or oil rigs. And it's a way that's palatable for human survival.
Right. So let's see. Many think that the Hawkins view is the only one held by Green Party members, but this is not the case. As the last panelist, I emphasize, as the writer speaking, that the Green New Deal focuses on producing energy from different sources rather than producing less energy. It is based on the belief that human happiness comes from an increasing quantity of possessions, something that flows directly from capitalism's urge to infinitely expand production. Most of my comments focused on 15 myths of clean renewable energy, which are detailed in Counterpunch, the publication.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah.
I mean,
any complaint that any natural mainstream normie / everyday person, they understand the problems with just consumer culture. It's entrenched. Everyone knows there's problems with it. But again, either there's a lack of imagination of what we could have instead, or the alternatives that they do see, hippie culture or new age culture, which is less materialistic, it then becomes its own form of irrationality.
Yeah, yeah.
At least as I see it.
It's a difficult question how to challenge that urge that capitalism puts in us to constantly consume, and that pairs satisfaction with the consumption of products. The system's own internal drive is to infinitely expand, and it's a drive that it places within all of its subjects. And challenging that is a tricky one. It's a deep question.
So let's see. And tackled in many different ways, even within capitalist spaces. It's like they know something's wrong, they're trying to fix it, but they just can't get a handle on it. So it just seems like it goes around in circles. Despite myths that they do not contaminate water, talking about renewable energy, they do not require much land use or have no effect on wildlife and human health, alternative energy does all of these. Despite assumptions to the contrary, many people are not joyous to have alternative energy harvested or its necessary components mined near their homes. Environmental defenders are killed for opposing it. It is not efficient in resource use. Energy efficiency and recycling will not solve its difficulties. I've covered in the past that solar panels aren't recyclable. And many wind turbines made with plexiglass aren't recyclable either. And they're made of steel. The most problematic myth is that there's no alternative to alternative energy. Large numbers of environmentalists and humanists have long advocated less energy use via changing production, that would have to be planned, to what people of the world need, rather than what corporations in rich countries desire for profit. No one on the panel or in the audience had any disagreements with Medicare for All, jobs with livable wages, or affordable housing. There were serious discussions, however, about whether a World War II-type mobilization would help or hinder the environment overall, and if instead of creating millions of jobs through massive investment, we could instead lower unemployment by shortening the work week. With much of the discussion challenging Hawkins' reliance on increased production, he promised to think more regarding the concerns raised.
Hmm. I think this touches upon the need to make sure that the Green New Deal and, you know, our style of politics and engaging with our problems as a whole is democratic, because if the production of solar panels is exploitative, if it's
and it is,
and if it's like continues to like degradate people, then it risks this like retaliation against a thing that might be helpful temporarily as like a stopgap measure.
It makes me think of Looper, which is
Looper.
A site. Did you see Looper?
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that to drop. What did make you think of
the
Looper?
Director pointed out that, like, you know, I'm making this vision of the future that's sort of just pretty much dystopian, but it has all these like interesting texts that we can imagine or seem practical, like the cars are have solar panels on them. Everything is like cleaner, more or less. But then, of course, the hierarchies of the past still exist. Nothing has really actually gotten better. Things are still very oppressive.
Well, one thing that's better is...
But the cars have solar panels on them.
Yeah, and they have those cool blunderbuss things.
The guns.
Like,
yeah.
Those guns. Like, it, I don't know.
So you don't have to aim.
Yeah, it looked cool. I liked the way they would hold them. It kind of looked, like, small. Like, you could really hold it. I don't know. I'm looking forward to those near dystopian cheap future guns. You know, I want something easy to
handle. I think in the form of 3D printed guns, that's the case.
Yeah, but don't they? They're not printing new types of guns. They're just able to create
old ones.
A gun. And I think are they able to make a plastic gun yet? Or mostly plastic.
One? I think it's being experimented. Their experiments.
I mean, that sucks, because that's just a slip.
Let's continue, because his participation in two other panels revealed the conclusion he reached from that thinking. The first was during the evening. So this is like, now we're fast forwarding to a different conference, which was the Missouri Green Party's yearly event, in which, so there's an evening panel with a number of people that will be mentioned now. So one was, he wrote this in a way I wish he didn't. So there's Amy Ramirez, Jim Evans, Dario Hunter, Hawkins again, and himself. Ramirez is a young director of the Sunrise Movement. So again, director of the Sunrise Movement. So Evans, representing Renew Missouri, had played a key role in blocking the building of a coal power plant in Kansas City. He endorsed financial and ecological advantages of the Democrats' Green New Deal. Again, the Sunrise Movement's position. So what we need to talk about is stewardship and taking care of our resources, a.k.a. conservation. Having a view similar to many in the Green Party, he noted, though, these are the words that we can use to get the point of less across. So instead of just saying we need to do less, or produce less or work less, because we're all working ourselves to death. We just need to talk in terms of stewardship and conservation.
Yeah.
I think that's a bad idea, because I feel like the environmental movement has been doing that for decades, and they haven't grown any of their, like, they haven't made, I mean, I guess some inroads have been made, but not by their.
Yeah. When it comes to, like, you know, slow growth or like anti-growth arguments when it comes to expanding economic capacity, it just needs to be framed in a way that, like, look, like scaling down or using less, that doesn't mean lowering the quality of people's lives. In fact, it'll mean the opposite. As we
and our economy has been growing by 2% for decades, and
yeah, the stock market's higher than ever, and we don't.
What are you getting out of it? And if you're not getting anything out of it, then what's the point of it?
Yeah.
The audience then heard from, okay, so Hawkins, with his second trip to Missouri in 3 months, reminded the audience that he offered the first Green New Deal program in the U.S. Then he criticized the Democrats' program of watering down his plan by allowing nuclear power, ignoring the military, and leaving polluting industries in the hands of capitalists. Hawkins linked his ideas to eco-socialism and that we must challenge capitalism, or that the Green New Deal should do that. The audience then heard from Dario Hunter, the Ohio Green Party, who is also seeking the GP nomination. Just as Hawkins claimed that the DP version, Democrat Party, of the Green New Deal is too weak, Hunter criticized Hawkins' version for lacking what was necessary overall. Hunter also referred to a World War II-type mobilization, but said that the Green New Deal must be part of a far greater effort, meaning a global one. He claimed that the Hawkins version said nothing about world geopolitics. As the U.S. outsources production to China and so on, it has simultaneously outsourced its carbon footprint, which results in understating how much carbon this country is actually responsible for. So even if we reduce U.S. emissions, a lot of China's emissions and India's emissions that we're saying that, you know, right-wingers will say is important, and like, why should we cut if they don't?
Yeah.
Well, their emissions are to make the stuff you buy in Walmart.
Exactly. Like, the production centers are tied to each other. Yeah, looking at it through the exclusively nationalist lens is not only, you know, inherently reactionary, it's also oversimplistic.
So thus, Hunter has his policy. He calls it the green path forward. Speaking last, again, the author, I noted that Hawkins observed shortcomings in the Democratic platform. Hunter realized that, and he kind of summarizes, I emphasize that it does little good to prevent the shattering of human civilization by climate change by proposing a huge expansion of toxins and species extinction brought about by covering the globe with solar panels and windmills. What humanity truly needs is to provide decent lives for everyone by reducing energy production. This led to multiple audience comments concerning, quote, how in the hell can we decrease production in a society inundated with capitalist propaganda that the road to ecstasy is paved with buying more stuff? But again, a lot of people don't like believe that. They're just kind of, what else am I supposed to do? But there is also the, like, as contrapoints, like, I like stuff. Anyway, one person brought up the need to reduce dams, which are ruinous to aquatic life and have their own sorts of damage they produce, and do not appear in printed forms of the Green New Deal at all. Others spoke of job loss resulting from decreased production of damaging products. You know, if we stop killing the puppies for the fur coats, then we'll have to fire people.
Yeah, that kind of...
That's a metaphor, I guess.
Yeah, that, like, sort of capitalist realist logic that, like,
yes.
Yeah, we can't, you know, nationalize healthcare, or, you know, pick any example, because, oh, it'll cost people jobs, because people's jobs are tied to, you know, the destruction of other people because they're cogs in that exploitative mechanism.
Blah.
So yeah, it's this method by which neoliberalism tries to create this kind of buy-in with the, well, there's already capitalist buy-in with the oppressive systems, but, like, gets you to kind of sympathize with your oppressors.
But that flowed into that a shorter work week should be included in any Green New Deal.
Yeah.
Which is what I would like to stress the most from this, is that, like, the shorter work week is really how we, like, the, if we want to, like, do less, then the best thing is just to work less.
Yeah.
Now, capital does not allow many people to work less. In fact, they demand we work more. And that's where one of those no, I matter, and I refuse. The next movement, you know, and I wish, would be instead of, not instead of, but, you know, on top of Occupy, Black Lives Matter, and Water is Life, should be, I want my time back.
Yeah.
And you're not going to take my time from me. You've taken enough of my time. I'm not getting a third job. I'm not going to Uber my way out of debt.
Yeah, it's reducing hours. Surviving.
Reducing hours of labor fed directly into the question, how would you win over voters? While people rarely want to give up what they have, they will much more readily forego what has not yet been put on the market. We discussed the idea that many people would gladly give up a new gadget designed to fall apart, usually a day after the warranty expires, or become out of style, if lowering production meant spending more time with friends and families. The discussion was drawing to a close with panelists giving their final comments when Hawkins dropped his bombshell. With a history of being a Green Party candidate for multiple offices, he announced that telling people we need to produce less is no way to get elected. Several of us were stunned. It was not so long ago that people could not get elected by proposing civil rights in the South, or opposed to Vietnam War, or the first two supporters of gay rights were definitely not popular. The only way any of these were made popular were by those willing to swim against the current. Instead of advocating what was necessary for human survival, the audience heard that Green candidates should put a wet finger in the air to find out which direction populist winds are blowing. 3 months after Hawkins told Greens in St. Louis that we would think about the negative potential of alternative energy, he told his Springfield audience that the best way to deal with it was to ignore it, which would be like the shortcoming I see in Hawkins. It's also an uber practical kind of unionist approach that he takes. He is a union guy first, no matter what.
Certainly. And it was interesting to hear that line from him, because I don't know. I'm perhaps a little ignorant of this, but like, isn't the entire point of like a third party movement that you're specifically not just taking the pragmatic immediate choice, that you are supposed to be charting this path forward without like compromising your values? Like that's
the way I've always seen it, which is why I'm like, why is Howie speaking this way, especially when like
electability arguments are weird.
He hasn't been successfully elected. He's come very, very close, but in Syracuse where he lives, but he hasn't won. So it's like, why are you making an electability argument? That's not. And again, this is in the closed doors, so to speak, of a Green Party space, right? There are the things that he says when he's in progressive spaces. You know, he does, it's context, you know, it's not just having a position for one audience and a position for another. It's more like what he's thinking about changes. But he is also an older man as well, and he is kind of more set in his mindset. And he is, I mean, he's a veteran, he's been an activist as long as Bernie has. With the same kind of track record, but instead of Bernie basically doing his, you know, if you call it selling out, it's not quite, but basically
I wouldn't call it that.
instead of being in a minor party, just running as an independent for Mayor Burlington, in which he got some center left buy-in.
Yeah, and
he
got in office and was able to enact a
lot of good things and he did some capitalist friendly things.
Yep.
And that's kind of how he's operated ever since. And that's kind of an argument made against, let's say, even if he wins the nomination, he's not going to purge the party because he's kind of subservient to them in a way. He's too nice. But it's an interesting question that, like, would he be so popular if he wasn't so nice?
Yeah, in a sense, I try to sort of de-emphasize the personal motivations of the individual, because that's the one thing we can't know. And what I kind of look at with Bernie's likelihood of attacking the party structure in a way that's more radical is, like, he's sort of building a coalition and a movement that's survival and continuance and sort of dependent on fighting these entrenched elites in this system of power. So it might not be so much about whether or not Bernie personally wants to be nice to Tom Perez. He might not have that option based on the...
That's probably his justification is he doesn't have a choice.
Yeah, and that's cool.
But I... I don't think it's that cool.
Well,
whenever you say I don't have a choice, I have to do this. I mean, that's kind of
the base
logic of anyone doing something immoral is I don't have a choice, and all the people around me aren't giving me a choice to do the good thing.
But wait, we're talking about him not having a choice in like purging the party and him personally not wanting.
Sorry,
to.
I'm relating it also to the last season of BoJack that I watched last weekend, which is one of the thing I drew out of it.
That
BoJack's a terrible person, but he's also surrounded by a lot of other terrible people who don't give him the choice to be good, better.
Right. To switch it.
And as long as he was around the other people doing like the thing he had to do to basically continue being an actor or a star.
Yeah, I haven't caught the last season yet, but when it comes to I don't so much look as politicians as people. That sounds a little
even though weird. That's kind of what the system demands.
The system like really tries to emphasize like the personality politics of it, but politicians are more like I don't know, see them as kind of like
the representatives.
Puppets or a kind of force or a representative that like has push and pull factors given on what depending on what has what is the coalition that leads them to success? What's the coalition that leads them to enact the policies that they want? And so if a politician has a different set of push and pull factors that cancels out a lot of the special interests that prevent normal politicians from enacting radical reform, then you're in a sense building a movement that's most major pull factor is the broad coalition of people that got him in charge and not like, you know, the traditional things that prevent people from going all the way. So that's something I kind of look forward to with Bernie is just less about him and his individual, more of the fact that, like, the movement that is coalescing around him, if he is going to be a successful politician, he's not really going to be able to back down from, say, Medicare for All or, like, waffle or equivocate. Because if he does, that'll be the end of him. And so he's too heavily invested in this more radical challenge of the structure.
That's
of power
why it's kind of the last dance.
To even be able to sell out if you wanted
any
to.
Any point, but I want to finish this up.
Green
so
stuff.
The last, there was a third panel. It was basically the next morning. Missouri Green Party members and interested onlookers again gathered for a panel, which basically just about the Green Party nominee process, which also now included David Rald of Massachusetts and Dennis Lambert, who is also from kind of a middle state. I think also Ohio. They had been asked to make opening statements regarding what would be their priorities as president. Hawkes gave his like eco-socialist Green New Deal and advancing Green Party electoral campaigns. Daryl Hunter announced his support for renewable energy as embodied in his Path Forward, which aims to address CO2 emissions globally rather than just the U.S. David Rald maintained, he's more of a Marxist-Leninist, maintained the climate change is caused by capitalism, and his solution would be to return the economy to the people, and thus more of a general state and planning. The candidates and audience brought up several issues that everyone seemed to agree with, but though important, these issues sidestepped the concern brought up the night before about the devastating effects of mining for clean energy, which isn't really clean. Hunter responded that we should move forward toward the... Oh, yeah, so this is the writer brought this issue up to the candidates on stage in the panel. So it's like, well, how do you respond to alternative energy that really isn't that clean? Hunter responded that we should move toward the cleanest technology that is available, or that's an option. Rawl believed that we should have a planned economy so that production does not cause pollution, at least as a goal. And Lambert indicated he was aware of problems with clean energy, but felt that renewable energy was the only way forward. There is no alternative to alternative energy, mentioned before. Environmentally minded listeners were again astounded as Hawkins quipped that clean energy is by definition clean. My first thought was that such reasoning would mean that using the label nonviolent death penalty would make an execution by definition nonviolent, or that instead of being a contradiction in terms, military intelligence would by definition intelligent. Hawkins maintained that clean energy could be accomplished by restorative techniques, but left me trying to figure out what techniques would restore a species made extinct by habitat destruction. It reminded me of Barry Commoner's term linguistic detoxification, which is when industry attempts to detoxify poisoning by labeling it with euphemisms. Mm. The series, and in conclusion, the series of discussions left Green New Deal supporters with as many questions as concrete proposals. Should every Green New Deal program call for an end to fracking, nukes, and dam building, nationalizing, and so on? And also the term useless production comes up to mind. Well, okay, I don't recall what paragraph, but just in terms of like shortening the work week, so much of what we produce is bullcrap jobs or bullcrap production. Widgets and crap in dollar stores.
Yeah, there are a lot of inefficiencies built into a system that's sort of tottering and desperate. Like a lot of, you know, the expansion of bureaucracies and like HR departments. I'm more thinking like college and school systems because that's kind of the world I know. Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of totally unnecessary labor happening. And so when it comes to like descaling things or like cutting back on production, a lot of it is like cutting out that kind of BS.
Oh yeah. David Graeber has his book, Bullshit Jobs.
Yeah. Yeah, that was mostly thinking of. Yeah, it's astounding the level of jobs that are totally unnecessary, even by the logic of the system that we have now, like jobs that don't actually add any value even to like the corporations. Finishing notes on the green thing. What are your thoughts?
Just that the useless production kind of reducing, needs to be. Not just like a side of the conversation, it just needs to be the conversation that any talk of, and this includes democratic socialism.
Yeah.
So like a general critique is that we are, even when we raise our standard of living, we're just still the middle class in a global economy. And that then there's a lower and underclass that exists abroad. Just as we're outsourcing like our production of carbon, switching to renewable energy is bad for them. It's exploiting a whole world of people.
Yeah.
And it's not, and it's just like, we're just maintaining the crap we have.
Yeah.
You know, the production of the phones and all the things that we know really aren't like we can go without and aren't always that great for us. And that if it was a choice between the thing that helps me get through my depressing day because of my 60-hour work week, or having a 30-hour work week and not having crap.
Yeah,
we'd all want to choose the latter.
Yeah, if the conversation is only limited to, throw your cell phones because they're bad. Like throw away the consumerist crutch that is like one of the only things that's keeping you going is you're kind of overworked.
But
if it's just limited to that pivot, it's not going to work. But it has to be also, yeah, like you said, shortening the work week, improving people's lives. It has to be
getting the sword of Damocles that the banks hold over us all the time. You know, the owners have owners.
Yeah.
And they all demand their cut. Just how much of the economy is scams and rent collecting.
Yep.
And libertarians and another like kind of centrists recognize this sometimes and it's as an epiphany, but then they don't do anything with it because the solution to it would be a place they don't want to go because socialism or anything, any left-wing idea is authoritarian because of their education. All they have to do is de-learn that and it just opens up the possibilities that's like, oh yeah, we could do, I'm open to this now. And I've seen that in action online.
Yeah, hopefully that happens a lot more.
So let's move on to the last, which is more of a gut punch. And again, it follows that whole, like, we're having the wrong conversation, even when we set out these super radical, impossible goals as far as our current political system is concerned. So it basically comes down to the answer to the pragmatic, well, you're not going to pass any of that in a Republican Congress. Okay, yeah. Then we're not formulating these policies to do it in Congress. Mm-hmm. We're formulating this vision for our new political system that we are also going to set out to build.
Yeah, and this article, what I love about it so much is A, it's very well written, and B, it it certainly challenges a lot of the type of activism I do, but it's a very compelling challenge and one that's very thought-provoking and doesn't really pretend to provide very easy answers. I'm in contrast, the articles you sort of talked about last time that were like critiquing, made an attempt to critique like activism writ large, but then sort of had this pretense of having something to offer in its place, but that part was really left blank. This one addresses
that.
Yeah, too. And it's more... So it's called No Way Out But Through, Beyond the Bobbleheads of Our Tottering World. And I'll read the first few paragraphs first, and then we'll get into it. Always the places of statecraft, which is to say the places of death. Borders have at times swallowed almost all political concerns before them. They now appear poised to do so with terrifying force. In Europe... Once in present sight of borders gone bonkers, this is clearest in the policy positions of its contending nations, and most spectacularly in the remaking of the electoral sphere into a pure contest of xenophobia, such that progressive parties essay to determine what precise degree of racism they must display in order to peel votes from the parliamentary avatars of ethno-nationalism. That's the centrist compromise position. Meanwhile, the Mediterranean dead... drowned en route to Italy and Greece, to Spain, Cyprus, and Malta, referring to the Syrian refugees mostly. They did not survive to meet La Lega and Golden Dawn, nor should they pass through those pickets to encounter the ruling parties of Poland's Law and Justice or Hungary's Fidesz as they journeyed inland, perhaps with the grand hope of reaching Germany, where the new formation of Aufsitzen, farcically demands a fortress leftism to keep pace with Alternative for Deutschland. So that's referencing a lot of far right-wing parties and fascist parties that are actively fomenting, and in Poland and Hungary actually taken power. So if you weren't privy on, you know, what Golden Dawn is, it's
a lot of Western Europe has gone right-wing. And also in a state in Germany, Thüringen, which I think is Rhinelandic area. The liberals have sided with the Alternative for Deutschland, which is the neo-fascist party, to block the forming of a left-wing coalition government.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I'm not privy on the movings of the German parliament right now.
It was a state parliament, but whatever.
Oh, state parliament, pardon. Skipping a paragraph down, the United States, fulfilling its historical mission to out-Europe Europe, perfects its own parallel pathologies. Muslim bands, armed vigilantes assisting the border patrol, concentration camps for migrants, some specializing in the torture of children, military budgets directed towards Azimandian border fortifications, a political economy of white supremacy for the end of the world. For the moment, terror dwells in the coalescence of these two phenomena, white supremacy and climate collapse. They increasingly form a unity, here taking the form of eco-fascist shooters maddened by fantasies of demographic and climatological inundation. They're the form of entirely non-fantastical migrants, set in motion across the planetscape by drought, by flood, by starvation. To say we must secure our borders, whether it is in the right nationalism of open xenophobia, the left nationalism that purports to protect labor markets and resources, or the strange synthesis developed by Angela Nagel and her ilk, referencing an article written a few months ago, not too important there, is to take the side of death. In some anonymous office in Northern Virginia, a team of well-dressed policy boys calculates the month and year that Canada's fresh water supply will need to be seized. So, there's an introduction. Yeah, really laying out.
I'm
on
trying
the table.
To look up what Osmondian means.
Yeah, Ozymandias. I don't.
Okay, it is. What? It is okay. Osmondius is an old biblical king, I think. A proud king whose empire and memory have long since crumbled into obscurity.
Oh wow! Yeah. So,
Osmondian walls would be walls that don't really serve a purpose anymore.
Yeah, it really highlights the fortress politics we're faced with in the 21st century, as the climate deniers transition over into climate accelerationists, as the argument is no longer capable of being refuted. Really, right, eco-fascism is sort of just the closing borders, letting people in other countries die off, or quickening the pace in which they die off through, you know, military interventions.
Arguments that boil down to overpopulation is an issue, and we need to do something about it. And there are many across the political spectrum that use it. And that's why there's a good effort on the left to combat overpopulation narratives for the eugenicist kind of thinking it is. And ecofascism just comes down to we're going to save, we do care about the environment, and we're going to save it by killing all the minorities.
Yeah, it's dark, and it's...
making life so terrible for minorities that they want to die, which happens to some extent already in American society.
So yeah, that's
look at suicide rates, where they happen.
Yeah, and that's what's referred to as the forming a unity between the phenomena of white supremacy and climate collapse.
Do you want to continue from there?
Yeah, yeah. Like all this, over all this, like a cloud of tear gas coalescing into a vast clown's head, leers Donald Trump, careening into the 2020 election, inviting us to fight his summoned white supremacists on their own terms, in the halls of power that are little more than the congealed violence of racial capitalism. Bernie Sanders, we hear, will clean house, revealing a new battlefield where the freedom struggle can be fought anew, history once again open for the seizing. I think I'll skip the next part.
Skip the UK.
Yeah, the UK, because it's talking about
Boris. But it's the same thing. He's saying the same thing.
Yeah. Elsewhere, impossible predicaments force crowds towards a thunderous no in Sudan, Puerto Rico, France, and Hong Kong, annihilating unloved policies when not evicting leaders from their palaces. But because these utterances are directed to the state, they too give way, ultimately, to its mortifying intrigues. I think I'll skip the Wallace Stevens part, because it's a little confusing.
True. I did find it a little weird. It's like, after the final no, there is a yes. And then it's like, well, what is that yes? That's really what we're fighting over, what the yes will be. Will it be an eco-fascist yes? Will it be a centrist yes? Or will it be our vision of yes? Yes to eco-socialism.
Yeah, and so this article is really just challenging highlighting how difficult, how dire our current position is, and how far we need to go, and how ill-equipped we are to get there with the tools we have right now. What?
Nothing, I'm just groaning.
Okay.
Because the thought of it, of all that, it's a lot of weight.
Yeah, yeah, it really,
and a lot of people don't want to handle it.
Yeah, it's hard to kind of...
But we can share that weight, mm-hmm. Which is why we do this.
Like that Beatles song.
Just to find more people to share that load and say, look, it's going to be a little hard at first, but the more of us are there, with 100 people, you can move a barn. Mm-hmm. Anyway, keep going.
So the article makes this difference between inductive and deductive political formations. And basically, it's the difference between pragmatic sort of DSA approaches, trying to put forth a radical vision while still dealing with the structures of power as they currently exist, versus how do I want to put this?
Deductive?
The deductive
You could
method,
consider it the utopian approach.
Yeah,
but
to sort of disavow the systems of power entirely and sort of try to create their alternate vision, but sort of believe, and it's not really a foolish notion, that engaging with the structures of power on their own terms will never yield results. Which,
valid
challenge.
Put it in newsworthy terms. One looks like a protest in a Capitol building or a sit-in at Pelosi's office, like the Sunrise Movement, and the other is anarchists squatting and doing some community work, providing food and Narcan and training people to not overdose. And they both kind of, there are two milieus that have existed simultaneously since 1980, when all of America's political problems were apparently solved. I say it with sarcasm.
Yeah.
Because it seems like we have a lot of narratives, like American politics were corrupt and untrustworthy until Reagan was elected, and then apparently now maybe it's just corrupt again. Or it's not obvious.
Yeah, so skipping forward a bit, when he highlights the problem, when they, because the article doesn't have one author, highlights the problem with induction, again, that's sort of this their way of putting the pragmatic sort of approaches.
The left wing of the possible.
Yeah, the left wing of the possible.
Which is the democratic socialist line, which is like democratic socialism is basically like the left we can build in America.
Mm-hmm.
We can't really go any more radical because people don't even have the civic imagination to think beyond welfare state and program and state spending. But of course, everyone's also distrustful of it at the same time.
Yeah, and
so it's actually I disagree that it's the left we can build, because even like in black disadvantaged communities, I mean, like, they don't just want stuff given to them. They're really suspicious of it if they're not directly involved. Even, you know, and even when they are involved, there's still kind of a lackadaisical, well, like, this, I didn't make this, I didn't earn it, I didn't take part in building this program, this platform, or the tree that you're going to plant in my yard. You can tell me how great trees are, but this is a story about Detroit tree planting,
right?
And how, because it was just a big white program that a lot of people in the hood refused.
Yeah,
and they'll refuse democratic socialism if it isn't radical, if it doesn't actually address what they've been pissed off about all these decades, which is the system.
You know,
it wasn't just a joke. I mean, it was kind of a joke. Like in high school, there was a guy who would keep disrupting band practice, and the teacher would deduct points from him and stuff. And he was like, "Man, the system's designed to keep the black man down." It was both kind of like a funny joke because like he is being a disruptive ass, while saying the system's because the grade and the point system that the teacher had. Anyway.
I mean, it's certainly true that we need to build these movements in a way that engages with people and doesn't put more burdens on them, like not interacting with the community way. Hey, go plant more trees. Like, yes, we should plant more trees, but also we need to address people's needs where they are.
Can you start reading at... I'll start reading it. The inductive method thereby is obligated to explain how we move from the electoral to the adequate, to the defeat of capital and state. So it's setting that out as our goal. We must defeat capital and state.
Yeah.
Much ink has been spilt on this topic to little effect. So how does electing Bernie Sanders and other AOCs, even if we elect 20 of them, how does that get us to defeating bankers? The tales told about this middle phase are too numerous to detail. Most notably, they promise the electoral triumphs and Green New Deal initiatives will provide the conditions for emancipatory struggle that will form in the wake of these wins and overflow the banks of presidents and policies.
That's sort of my hope for what's achievable with Sanders in particular. Like, I don't know if Medicare for All could actually happen. Of course, that isn't the revolution, and Bernie Sanders is not the revolution. But
it's what we hope. But here's the gut punch. There is no, or almost no, historical precedent for this favorite story.
Made
the one that's made explicit in Bernie's campaign materials. Thereby, reform projects are driven into the heart of the capitalist state by charismatic politicians. They hit the wall of entrenched bureaucracy and corporate power, and rather than being broken on the rock, summon to their aid social movements capable of pushing through that barrier or perhaps shattering the state altogether.
I've got the spot now. Instead, where such reform projects have emerged, they have been, without fail, the alternative offered by the left wing of capital to consolidate and recuperate an extant movement whose power lay in its indeterminate character, its aspirations a melange of reform and revolution, impossible to sequence in some singular way, where parliamentary projects lead and collective action is presumed to follow, whether in Britain's momentum, slowed to a crawl by parliamentary tableau vivants, geez, or the Green New Deal's policy of sponsored social movements, the mass mobilization already lies in state. So I do get that switching of cause and effect, this notion that like the policies would come first and the social movement comes afterwards. That is a switching of cause and effect. I definitely do agree
with the limitation of that. It's the logic of the South Park joke, like step one, step get underpants. Step two, step three, profit.
Right.
What's step two? And it's always very, it's all going to work itself out kind of thinking. The translation of like alternatives offered by left wing of capital to consolidate and recuperate.
Yeah.
Think the basic income proposed by Yang. It's like, when does it just become a buy-off from the rich to keep us from guillotining them?
I mean, certainly there, because like Yang's vision of universal basic income and the libertarian bent is to use UBI as an alternative for like unionized jobs and the welfare state is sort of buy off entire swaths of the population. And then that wealth would just be largely reabsorbed by the ruling classes, because if you're a poor person and you suddenly have an extra $12,000, you'll use it to settle your debts and improve your immediate circumstances.
And it's taking automation as a given.
And then it siphons
completely up. Ignoring that automation is, again, extremely energy intensive with all the computers and servers and whatnot. And the technology, again, has to be mined from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to run out. Or if it doesn't run out, we basically have to colonize space to get more of the minerals.
Yeah.
Which is all just ridiculous as far as, like, well, the planet will be dead by then.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a colonization of space, also becomes the solution to how we ruin our planet, which is so many sci-fi stories that are countless, as just thinking about, like, the extrapolation of the 20th century, instead of having a 21st century that in fact does something differently.
Yeah, and towards the critique the commune lays out of the inductive method, the left of the possible, I think the revolution that we need to overthrow capital in order for us to survive, that revolution doesn't seem to be on the foment right now. And I don't know, when it comes to, like, Green New Deal and, like, the maybe more reformist measures within it, it's like, if we can envision a future where a revolution is possible in 20 years, we need to still live in a civilization in 15. So, like, if we are able to, while, like, parallel revolutionary structures and more radical structures are building, if we're able to kind of cross-check capitalist power and leverage things in a way that are more survivable while we build that more radical movement to actually, you know, overthrow the state, take true democracy. And it's a difficult pitch. Like, there's a lot of problems with that.
A lot of moving parts
that the article points out.
Can't even understand at this point a lot of people around us.
Yeah,
where the long, you know, the education project comes, you know.
But then he also
let's talk about each of these concepts individually, so people can sort of get them, or get them as much as they can, which I do believe they can, because we're all pretty smart when given the chance.
Yeah,
do you want to keep going? I want you to describe the response for deductive method too.
So the deductive method, alternately, begins with a view of the whole and the necessary. It begins with historical fundamentals and first principles, the mission of the proletariat, the incorrigible logic of capitalism, the impossibility of proletarian state power, the correlation of emissions, global temperature, and growth. Against these predicates, all visions of emancipation must test themselves, whether they like it or not, and all current actions will fall short. In the long run, getting shorter each day. We must abolish class society or perish. But how do we get there from here? The deductive method runs the risk of pure utopianism, planning the cities of the future for some world other than ours. The goal matters little if there's no path there.
And that's the main critique against kind of the general utopian visions of, like, the Venus Project, the type that some leftists pitch, and they build kind of a cult around them.
Yeah.
Even if they don't want it to be a cult, it just kind of still has that air of, we're going to believe in this object of a plan instead of what kind of movement do we build to get there? Because then it becomes, I mean, the best activism they do is an education project based around the issues that their model raises and involves. Paracom does this too, and I like using it as an education tool to talk about labor and how we divvy up roles in workplaces. A lot of thought went into working out how we could do it better. And especially when it can be put in the parts and you can start with one workplace and doing it horizontally. Mm-hmm. Both methods to say become a lacuna. I have to look up that word too. The moment of hand waving in the exposition. For the deductive, the question is how to begin, where to start. Now, usually the slogan created by CrimeThink is to change everything, start anywhere. To change anything, change everything. Or to start anywhere, change everything. Whatever. But the point is, like, where to start, you start anywhere. Anywhere it looks like there's a need. And that is how natural processes work. You know, evolution is actually based on what is the next thing that is needed to survive.
To start somewhere, start everywhere. I don't know. I just kept thinking different versions of that slogan.
That's why I keep forgetting exact wording, even though I have, like, I've been handing out the pamphlets with the title
to
for
start
years.
At the end, begin anywhere.
Let's get some just quote Taoism. Let's see, to continue the reading.
Yeah.
Or perhaps not that exactly where to start, as we are suggesting that in the instances of Black Lives Matter, Standing Rock, Yellow Vests, and Abolish ICE, it has already begun, at least as a matter of potential. For the inductive, the moment of hand-waving covers over the question of how it is that submitting to the discipline of policy papers and national electorates can produce an international communism, adequate of the minimum task of ending class and capital. But how can demanding full employment, labor market protections at borders, and the depredations of growth, perhaps with green edges, lead to the end of wage labor or the end of borders? So we set out these goals, but our middle goals still seem to be, let's maintain things the best we can.
So
can you pick up the last few paragraphs?
Yeah, I think you can skip down to the last two, because I think we've gotten a sense of the this kind of dialectic between this deductive and inductive, the horizon of the possible versus the.
But he points out that there are many people, though it kind of included myself at one point a few years ago, where I thought I found a synthesis.
Right.
I think I said so in last episode about the Green Party, that I saw it as a middle ground between these kind of two things.
Yeah.
That it has this very aspirational platform, a vanity platform, as centrists call it, while interacting with the institutions of power via elections, but not playing the Democratic Party's game, which Democratic Socialists do, where you are still, like, once you're elected in an office, the party can still put an enormous amount of pressure on you, and you vote for war budgets, and you call Maduro a dictator. You support two-state solution in Israel. These are all things. I'm talking about Bernie right now.
Well, Bernie didn't vote for the military budget.
Okay.
But yeah, he voted against.
I think AOC
Trump's
did.
Military
though.
Budget each time. Did AOC vote for the military budget? That would surprise me. I mean, yeah, she's well, had.
Whether
she's
it,
had
whether
some
it's
missteps,
whether it's
definitely.
Clear cut, yes or no, they're not like saying the military needs to be cut.
Yeah, they are.
They are.
Oh yeah, definitely.
By half. Well,
Yeah. Like, I believe that is Sanders' platform, to cut the military by half. He actually emphasized it
Isn't the center attacking him on that? Bernie doesn't want you to be safe.
Because the central pivot of his platform has been Medicare for all and, like, raising minimum wage.
But not cutting the military. Right. It's not a main pivot. That's just how we pay for it.
Yeah. American politicians don't talk about foreign policy as much overall. Like, it's not, like, those issues.
It's a third rail, but yeah, I mean,
it's not just a third rail, but, like, those aren't the issues that generally win you an election, because the American public is.
I got
very
you. Yeah, right,
stuff.
Right, and that's yeah, and that, so that's why Howie also kind of ignores international policy when he makes his pitches,
yeah,
and speeches and talks.
I mean, at the CNN debate, the one before this one, CNN started off by asking, Bernie Sanders, you've called for demilitarizing the Middle East. The Ayatollah of Iran also wants to demilitarize the Middle East. Why do you agree with him?
okay.
Just this amazingly xenophobic.
So I guess that's the stuff I don't know, because I don't watch the debates.
Yeah.
So-called debates.
Yeah, so I would say there is something there. I wouldn't say it's...
Okay, so we're the last...
But anyways, last two paragraphs.
Okay. Nonetheless.
So approaching a synthesis to these two components... Nonetheless, there is something totalizing about the slogans and the mass action they convoke. So, referring to Black Lives Matter,
the movements of the last 10 life. Years.
Yeah, et cetera, et cetera.
Occupy Wall Street, you know, smash the banks.
Yeah. Something that can't be banished. Not only because, in order to achieve the indictment of a single cop, you need to burn half a city, but because they frame a goal far in excess of any single reform. You can't abolish ICE, in truth, without abolishing policing and borders, and thereby the state as such. You can't make Black Lives Matter in the U.S. without ending the differential valuation of lives, which is to say, without overthrowing racial capitalism. In this sense, the first principles of deduction appear as a dim image described within the partial objectives of the movement, something made apparent in its every encounter with the organized violence of the state and the passive power of capital. Our interpreters in the halls of power will never hear these slogans in their fullness, nor can they ever be adequately interpreted by any figure of leadership but our own self-organization. We cannot find our unity. We cannot become a we in the projects of the state. That must be built solidarity by solidarity, neighborhood by neighborhood, workplace by workplace, in struggles that directly interlink our material well-being. There will be no common plan before it's far too late to devise one, no charismatic leader, no single yes in the place of the grand no on which we can all agree. But in forcing ourselves forward, without knowing the way in advance, without delegating our power to the bobbleheads of our tottering world, pointed at adequate ends rather than the battlefield of foreclosed means, we give ourselves a chance to find a way. We're smarter than any of them because there are millions of us, and we're stronger because they can't kill us all. No borders can stop us.
So nice. Do you think in by next year we'll both be members of the Red Black Rose Federation?
I don't know. It depends on how
it all depends on how things shake out this year. But yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, so the translation from me is, in a way, or summary, is that, you know, if we're going to take the, and, you know, to more in our minds, and we make the case for it as much as we make the case that engaging with elections is sort of worth it, if we're not going to engage with elections anymore, which might be the conclusion of many, many people after this year, what needs to be, the alternative is militant organizing, place by place, small scale, but then it can build up into these broader coalitions / syndicates.
Yeah.
Bring back syndicalism. There's a meme where it's like, things are, now that's the 2020s, things we're going to bring back from the 1920s.
Flappers and syndicalism.
Flappers, Charleston, anarcho-syndicalism.
Dope. Let's do it.
And yeah. And I'm like, you know what? That actually makes a ton of sense. With everything that I've been thinking and the way I've been going about things and the conclusions I've drawn year by year, election by campaign or lobby by lobby, and everything else. It's like syndicalism seems to be what can work to have a left for itself, theory-wise and practice-wise.
I mean, I'm in favor of using every weapon at once that we can devise, so yeah. Definitely.
Which is why the election thing is still on my list of look, I'm okay with running elections if it's independently in an independent party with independent funding, which is where the Green Party, we want it to be like a union where it is like a militant organization where we're running militant elections where we're like, no, we're not cross endorsing. We're not trying to make nice with you like the Working Families Party does. It also means that we can't really work with the Libertarian Party like we probably should be doing, especially as the Libertarian Socialist Caucus gets more clout there. Any parting thoughts before we go?
No, just, use every weapon at once, build solidarity, and we have a very slim window, but we might just be able to get through it, and there's...
It takes 10 years to really, build a project well.
There's no way out but through. There's even if there's a 1% chance we'll actually make it through this, we have to put all our chips on that table because what else are you going to do?
Hope. Fool's hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
What am I quoting now? I can't even remember. No, I know.
Radical hope is the only pragmatic thing.
Yes. So my profound thanks for everyone listening. Listening is an important skill, often as important as talking. So I plan to listen to any constructive feedback you send in, ideas for the show, or stories and topics you'd like to hear discussed. Because living in a capitalist economy isn't very free, especially when it comes to doing valuable work like this, please support the show by telling others about it, like sharing and doing the obvious social media stuff, I have no reviews on any podcast app, so if you could do that, that would be great. Everything helps. Patreon page, if you want to give a few bucks, I will be supporting our membership program for this community-run radio station where we're all volunteers. Any proceeds from Patreon page go to the station, which is a community effort, which is, in my view, one of those solidarity actions that isn't just me sitting alone in my house doing a podcast, which many podcasts are. This is also a shared experience where I'm helping educate other people how to use the radio. Social media on Twitter and Facebook only. Facebook has live streams, but there's also a YouTube channel, which I will be uploading more of those live streams to, as well as other types of video content eventually, but I am getting better at doing that stuff. Eventually, I want to do a newscast, which includes having, you know, the public access TV station needs a teleprompter for me to do that, but otherwise that's also a goal as well. The full archive of episodes is at threelefts.news. That is it. And it's well descriptive now. So thank you very much. Stay radical, stay frosty, stay warm in this wintertime while we still have it.
Thanks for having me on. Bye, everybody.
Bye.